Hello and welcome to the Turley Frequency, live and exclusive here this morning on Archangel Radio. As they say in the movies, we have found each other. Well, they say that in bad movies. Anyway, good morning and welcome to this freshly minted edition of your favorite morning talk radio show. And how are you this great Thursday? We're nearly there. Hang in there. Tomorrow's Friday. I can feel the weekend beckoning as I speak. Now, on the show today, we are talking hoaxes and conspiracies, and in particular those pertaining to London in the 1660s, when powerful and shady groups of individuals were manipulating the populace into an anti-Catholic fervor, which was sadly to result in tragic consequences. The author and academic John Stater joins us in the next segment to enlighten us further on what has become known in history as the Popish Plot. The Divine Mercy is as usual at the top of the hour, and you are invited to join us for that prayer. Feel free to text in your requests on 251-928-2111. Or if you prefer, phone the show after 9 a.m. Central on 888-928-0881, when we would be only too glad to take your prayer requests live on air. Now, story time continues with the 1660s of London and a saint that walked unknown among the cobblestones of a city then in the grip of that aforementioned anti-Catholic frenzy. So, I have but one question for you. Are you ready to tune into the Turley Frequency? Well, good for you. Let's get on with this show. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Turley Frequency this Thursday. I hope you're doing well, you know. Like you, I'm thinking it's Thursday. Thursday's a fun day. It's a nice day. It's a good day because it's nearly Friday, right? We're nearly there at the weekend. Now, I thought today we would have a new feature on the show, which is some of the correspondence that we get sent to us here at the Turley Frequency. Yes, you can't believe it. And I'm just going to read out snippets of that. I will make it all anonymous. I will just use initials for people. So don't worry if you've written in, you are not about to be outed on air with your views on the show. So. Wonderful. Mr. Postman, I mean, I'm not sure many of these came via the post or the mail, but still, it's nice that people are communicating with the show, and I heartily encourage you to do so. Text in 251-928-2111. Those lines are open 24 hours a day for you to communicate with us. Say anything you like, comment on the show, comment on our guests, comment on Dave and Mike, anything like that. We are happy to receive all comments. So let's begin with AK. AK contacted us. I'm going to leave out where people are contacting from because that might give away who's who. So AK, good morning to you. And AK enjoyed our spots on UFOs and extraterrestrials and all that. And he's saying, can you guys have more UFOs on? Really enjoyed that the other day. Well, AK, we try to have an eclectic mix, as you know, on this show. We try to do everything, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. It's all here. And that's just the three of us. But we try to do everything. We try to make sure that we are entertaining and giving you a great mix. There is nothing out of bounds, really, on this show. Obviously, we're not going to promote anything against the church or against moral teachings or against the good of any individual. But there's lots and lots of things to talk about. And we like to talk about all those things. So, yes, AK, thank you for that. We will be covering UFOs, I'm absolutely certain. Maybe one will land on the studio roof and we'll send Reed up to interview them. JB writes, can you have show notes on the website as I need to find out more about your guests? Yes, JB, thank you for that. We are working on that. We are going to have more extensive show notes in due course. Absolutely. and only too happy to do so, to give you websites and various other things. What I would say is that if you want to, you can always go back and listen again on the website to the various episodes, when you will hear our guests giving out their website addresses and so on. So it's all there already. But yes, we will be working on show notes. A question for me from Hitch. It says, Mr. Turley, who is your favorite saint? Well, Hitch, I cannot for the life of me answer that question. I have so many. Depends on what day of the week it is. Depends on what time of the day it is. It depends on what mood I'm in. I have lots and lots of saints that I love and revere. I hope to love and revere very many more. There is no end to the amount of saints. It's wonderful discovering the lives of the saints, and it's wonderful discovering new saints that we can get to know. Because the thing about saints is they're not fictional characters that we can admire, or even historical characters that we can feel some affinity to. Saints are living, breathing people. They are alive in the sense that they are in heaven and they are close to us. We can call upon their aid. And certainly on this show, we ask for the intercession of St. Maximilian Kolbe, one of the great patrons of radio, and also St. Gabriel. He is a patron of radio as well. So maybe St. Maximilian and St. Gabriel today as we are on the show. Gigi asks, Mr. Turley, what do you think of our American politicians? Well, Gigi, I think of your American politicians about as much as I think of the British politicians, which is not a lot, really. I try not to think about them, especially when I'm eating. Politicians are politicians. They mean well sometimes, and that's as much as we can hope for. So I think politicians need prayer. I've got a statue, as you know, of St. Thomas More not far from me, and he's the patron saint of politicians. I think we should pray for our politicians and probably not expect very much from them. C, thank you for your email and thank you for your kind comments about the show. But I think you got something wrong, because you write loving Mike and Reed being on air so much. I'll just read that again. Loving Mike and Reed being on air so much.
We're supposed to be the villains.
Well, I think, see, you've obviously not been listening enough. I think they're on the air a bit too much sometimes, I have to say. But I'm glad that you're enjoying their contributions. You know, at the end of the day, they mean well.
Yeah.
They mean.
I don't see anything wrong with that.
neither does C.
Maybe Michelle will say, you know, enough of this Turley guy. Let's just get Mike and Reed their own show. Totally kidding.
enough of that. And Michelle, if you're listening, we wish you well. D writes about the eggs. We were talking about eggs the other day, and D writes, when it comes, and she writes about the eggs and so forth. And then she concludes, when it comes to eggs, as the French say, one egg is enough. Okay. So that is what is known. Exactly. That is what's known, Dee, as a listener with material. Okay. And we encourage it. We encourage it all the time, because, boy, do we need some help with some material here. Now, we have another text here. It's a little bit more to the point. Mr. Turley, I think you are rude and way off the mark, but I accept your apology and I've spoken to my pastor and will be calling you again. Signed, C. Okay, C, thank you for that. You know, you're always welcome on the show, and there is no subject out of bounds, C, and you are certainly not out of bounds. And if I'm off the mark, well, it's your job to bring me back to the mark. And finally, E writes to us. Yes, thank you, E, for your contribution and for your extremely long and detailed correspondence. Which concludes with, you are part of the media industrial complex. You do not fool me with your CIA-funded propaganda. Well, E, I can tell you this. If the CIA want to fund this show, then I am all ears, right? If you can get me a number to their commercial department, I will be straight on the phone after the show, and we will be having we'll have the Divine Mercy sponsored by the CIA. How about that, E? But thank you. So thank you all our correspondents from around the country, and keep it coming in. We love hearing what you think of the show.
We've got to fund it somehow, right, Kevin?
Got to
fund the show somehow.
Yeah, so. The CIA probably has a huge budget. As long as we are still doing Catholic media, then that's definitely something we'd be interested in.
Well, maybe we should rebrand ourselves as the Catholic Information Agency or Catholic Information Airwaves.
That's CIA. Genius, Kevin.
And then all that slush money that comes to the CIA accidentally comes into Ellen's bank account. And Bob's your uncle, Fanny's your aunt. As they say. So listen, if there's anything you want to talk about this morning, you can call in on 888-928-0881. And there is no subject out of bounds. There is no anything you want. Catholic teaching or politics of the day, economics, American football. I'll do my best. Anything you like. We will talk about it on air because this open lines, the next 10 minutes is open lines and it's your time. It's your time. You are our listener. You are the most important person in this room at this moment. And I am delighted to have your company and extremely interested in what you think, what you feel.
Kevin, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine, Reed. Good morning.
I was just wondering, when Super Bowl Sunday comes around for, the UK, I know some people watch it in the UK. It's probably not, a huge deal over there. Do you even turn it on, or is that not something that you're interested in?
Super Bowl to me, Reed, is Sunday lunch, mm-hmm. and there's a large bowl of pudding of some sort, dessert, and that's what my Super Bowl is.
There you go.
I don't know. When does the Super Bowl take place in America?
It is going to be Sunday at 5:30 our time, so that'll actually be in the middle of the night, I'm sure, for you.
You mean it's happening this weekend?
Yes, sir.
Oh, and who's playing? Who are the competing teams?
It is the Kansas City Chiefs versus the Philadelphia Eagles, and I personally and Mike am going for the Eagles because there are some University of Alabama stars who won championships for Alabama who are on the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah. Well,
Mike, you know exactly. Yes, I'm all about the Philadelphia Eagles too. So there are a couple of a few Alabama players that the former Alabama players that are playing for the Eagles, and I'd like for them to get that Super Bowl. I think if one of the players, wide receiver Devontae Smith, won the Heisman. For Alabama, was the first wide receiver to win. The Heisman is the most decorated player, the best player.
It's the Ballon d'Or of college football.
Yeah, yeah, oh, exactly. Wow. So anyway, he would be like the third or fourth. Face. Yeah, he would be the third or fourth player in the history to win a national championship, a Heisman, and a Super Bowl. So to have that to his credit, to his achievements.
Well, you know, Mike, as you're talking, I'm just thinking I must relearn Cantonese because this makes about as much sense to me. Listen, I will make one prediction for the event on Sunday.
Okay.
And I'm absolutely certain in this that the winner will be a Chief Eagle. That I am absolutely sure. Okay. Now, let's get this show on the road. 888-928-0881. Anybody out there that wants to speak to me about anything, we are happy to do so. Now, as I was rooting through the New York Times this morning for your benefit, I came across a very interesting article about Steve Bannon. You know who he is? Do you remember him? You might not know that Steve Bannon took over Mike Church's show when he left Sirius XM. Yeah, yeah. Steve Bannon was the fill-in host for Mike Church. Can you believe it? But anyway, Steve Bannon's career on air has gone from strength to strength because he is now doing a podcast, which I hadn't heard of, called War Room. And the New York Times has given him a lot of publicity today because it is saying that he is the biggest misinformation spreader out there. Now, I don't know about you, but Mr. Bannon must have woken up this morning and clapped his hands with glee that the New York Times would be making him public enemy number one when it comes to podcasts. Because, you know, that's great publicity. People like me who weren't really that familiar with the podcast, what are we going to do? going to go off and listen to it, right? What's all the fuss about? So they make a big, long article about Steve Bannon and the false, misleading, unsubstantiated statements, allegedly, in his War Room podcast, which fine. Okay, that's the New York Times. But then they have a kind of top 10 of the worst offenders. And a lot of the shows there you'd kind of expect, okay? They've got Sean Hannity, Mark Levine, Michael Savage. But guess who's number three? Rush Limbaugh. Now, I don't know about you, but last time I looked, that man died 2 years ago. How can he still be spreading misinformation? I mean, is this some sort of seance that the New York Times is holding with Rush? I mean, how can they come to the conclusion that 15.2% of his current show is misinformation? I think it's 100% misinformation because he's not alive. He's not doing his show anymore. Listen, if you've got a view on misinformation, call me. 888-928-0881. Only too glad to take your call.
Kevin, we do have a caller now.
Oh, great. Fantastic. I love callers. Who have we got this morning, Reed?
We'll find out. Let's see who it is.
Yeah.
Hello?
Oh, hello. Through to the Turley frequency. Who am I speaking to?
Hi, my name is Kristen. I'm calling from
Kristen.
San Bernardino. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Where are you calling us from? San Bernardino. Is that California?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. It's early in the morning for you,
yes.
Kristen.
I know. You guys were like doing like a show yesterday, and you had like an actress and stuff.
Mm-hmm,
and
that's right, Nicole Abesinio.
Right. Like I was wanting to get into that, and are you gonna like, you know, like have her back? Because I wanted to call and ask a question to her because like. You know, I'm interested in becoming an actress and stuff, and I wanted to know, like, what I need to do to, like, you know, like, do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, Kristen, how old are you?
I'm 16.
Well, you're very young to be, are you sure you want to be an actress? That's the first question.
I mean, it looks cool and stuff. And, like, you know, they make a lot of money, and, you know, I like to shop. And anyway, I just, you know, wanted to know more about it. Like, I want to do, like, horror films and, like, you know, get to scream and stuff. Like, you want to hear my scream?
Yeah. Go for it.
Is that good?
Kristen,
is that good?
I think you've got a big career ahead of you in movies. I really do. I think if you can come on the radio at 16 and start screaming, I think that's fantastic. Kristen, I think the first thing I would do is speak to your parents. Speak to your parents about this because, as you know, I have some experience of that world, and it's not for the faint-hearted, and it's not a world that should be entered into lightly. It's a difficult path to trod. It's very, very rewarding, as you suggest. Maybe have you been on stage at your high school? Maybe done a school play or something?
I don't know, not yet. I'm a little scared. Like, I don't know, like nervous. Like, I want to do not like stage work, but like, I want to do like films and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's not mm-hmm. really like at our school, we don't like have a drama program that does like films. And stuff, so you know, like I just don't know where to go.
Well, I tell you what, Krista, I mean, unfortunately Nicole isn't here today to answer your questions. It's a shame you didn't call yesterday while she was on air. But listen, why did you call back? I mean, we're all about vocation on this show. We're all about helping people find their vocations, and we'd be delighted. I mean, maybe other people can call in and help you with this. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great calling, you know, it's a holy calling if it can be offered to the Lord, but it's a pretty difficult path you're setting out on there, Kristen. But listen, unfortunately, I've got to go to the commercials at this point. Listen, call again, Kristen, and thank you very much
okay.
for listening. That was Kristen out in California who wants to be an actress in Hollywood, which is great. So, Kristen, call again, and thank you for listening. Now, when we come back, we are going to be changing our tune because we're going to be talking about a hoax, a historic hoax, which had tragic consequences for Catholics here in London. You've got to stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Now, just before the break, we were talking about Steve Bannon and the War Room podcast. And wherever you are on the political spectrum, it's safe to say we live in an era of fake news and far too many conspiracies of one sort or another to recount. However, if you think things are bad today, then spare a thought for Catholics living in London in 1678, because that was the year of what has become known as the Popish Plot. This plot was fabricated by a handful of perjurers who claimed that the Catholics of England planned to assassinate King Charles II. Fantastical tales were weaved into the then prevailing anti-Catholic mood in a calculated move to undermine the then Stuart court. These lies and fantasies had a vicious outcome, resulting in the execution of over a dozen innocent Catholics and the imprisonment of many more, some of whom later would die in custody. Now, Yale University Press have just published an intriguing work called Hoax, The Popish Plot That Never Was by LSU history professor Victor Stater. And he joins me down the line this morning. Victor, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
Victor, you can probably hear by my accent that I am from these islands on the other side of the Atlantic. So I have heard of the Popish Plot and I lived through its consequences to some extent. But many of our listeners will have no idea what I'm talking about. Could you give us a kind of overview of what was this Popish Plot?
Yes, well, your introduction is a very good summary of what was going on, but more broadly speaking, it was a fantastical set of events that grew out of several things. One being the inordinate fear that Protestant English people had of Catholicism in general. That was at the heart of much of what was going on. But also it was a reflection of politics and political divisions in which opponents of the government of the day, led by King Charles II, were attempting to undermine that government. And then it had a lot to do with the incredible lies and falsehoods peddled by just a handful of ambitious and desperate individuals, chief among whom was the infamous Titus Oates, whose tale started the whole ball rolling.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, Victor. I mean, of all the figures in certainly that period of British history, I have to say that Titus Oates is one of the ugliest characters ever to emerge from under a stone. I know I'm probably a little bit biased, but he isn't. There's nothing likable about him, is there? He betrays everybody.
Absolutely. In my view, and I've been a historian of Stuart Britain now for 40 years, there is nobody that I have ever come across who is as downright evil as Titus Oates was in virtually every aspect of his life. He was he was a serial perjurer. He was a swindler. He was a pederast. He was any bad category you can imagine, he fit.
Yeah, I mean he's slightly intriguing almost because he is so evil in a sense, you know. I mean, one wonders, because the other thing was this, there was the veneer of religion, and he changed religions willy-nilly to suit his purposes. One minute he was an out-and-out Protestant, the next minute allegedly he was in with the Jesuits, and so he seemed to have absolutely no principles and no morals, and yet he is at the center of this plot, which I suppose, moving it out from the historical frame a little bit, Victor, you know, what fascinates me about this period of history and has fascinated other commentators and writers from the past is how much personality has dictated history. And in Stuart England, post-Reformation, Stuart England, that, to my mind, is very much to the fore. Would you agree with that?
I think that's true. One of the main reasons for that, I think, is, first of all, it is a personal monarchy, and the key figure in that monarchy is the king. And, of course, Charles II's personality is one which is endlessly fascinating, not altogether golden, but he certainly had his faults. But yes, personality. And then again, on the other side, you have some remarkable personalities like the noble opponent of Charles, the Earl of Shaftesbury, who himself was a figure of fascination.
You're listening to the voice of Professor Victor Stater, who's an LSU history professor, but is also the author of the recently published Hoax, The Popish Plot That Never Was, currently available through Yale University Press. Yes, do you want to, Victor, just give a little quick run through of 17th century British history for our listeners, because so much happened. I mean, we had, you know, the Stuarts came and went and all the rest of it. Do you want to just give us the kind of run up so it sets the scene for 1678 so that people can understand just what the pressures were at that point?
Sure. One of the most important things to bear in mind is the mid 17th century civil wars between supporters of the Stuart monarchy, in particular King Charles I, and his opponents who accused him of tyrannical rule and ultimately triumphed over him, resulting in his trial and public execution. Following that, you had a period of almost 11 years in which Britain, and that includes Scotland and Ireland too, were dominated by a regime which was at first declared a republic and then afterwards a sort of quasi-monarchy led by the parliamentarian general Oliver Cromwell. Well, Cromwell was the main force behind the success of that regime. And when Cromwell died, ultimately it staggered forward for some months and then collapsed. And the consequence of that was the restoration of the monarchy in the person of Charles I's eldest son, Charles II. Mm-hmm. And one of the key points to bear in mind in all of this is that the civil wars revealed deep divisions within Britain between those who saw the parliamentary side as the legitimate leaders of British politics, and those who saw the monarchy as the key. And those divisions were not healed by the Restoration, despite the fact that it was actually made illegal. Parliament passed a law, the so-called Act of Oblivion, which made it a criminal offense to even refer to an individual's side in the Civil War. You weren't allowed to even comment on it. Of course, the need for that statute suggests that the divisions had not gone away. And the emergence of the opposition to King Charles was really rooted in these Civil War divisions. Those who earnestly believed in the reality of the plot were by and large people who had sympathized with or actually supported Parliament side during the Civil Wars. Whereas those who were skeptical tended to be people who had been royalists. And so the plot has the effect of once again creating this breach between the two sides. And that blows up into a political crisis, which was aimed at, first of all, the overthrow of Charles II's ministry, but more importantly, the exclusion of his brother and heir apparent, James, Duke of York, from the succession.
And that's the other thing that's very, very current in that century throughout. And the Stuart monarchs kept chopping and changing. But it's this kind of, in the background, there's always this shadow of Catholicism and foreign takeovers of Britain, or that somehow the Stuarts were weak in terms of the Reformation, and that they were more inclined to Rome than the Reformers. And that's a constant backdrop to all of this, because it can be lost in modern times, where religion sometimes isn't as important in different countries. It's certainly not important in modern day Britain, in a sense. But in 17th century Britain, religion was the key. I would say it was the key fuel for whatever was the major gripe. Is that too simplistic, do you think, Victor?
No, I think that's quite accurate. In fact, I might even further define it by saying that the real issue was fear and hatred of Catholicism amongst the Protestant majority.
And just to give people a little bit of background, Victor, because the Reformation at this point, it's about in Britain is about 100 years, just 100 and odd years old, you know, and it's still settling down, and it's still a moving, you know, the Tudors sort of waxed and waned in different directions. And then at the start of this century, we have King James coming down from Scotland, and he's the first Stuart king of Britain. And then we have the Stuarts throughout, and they do seem to sort of, as I say, they move between these factions almost. And I wonder, I mean, was the Stuarts' religious dispensation a kind of political pose, in the sense that were those movements to do with power rather than theology?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think you have to actually think about individual Stuart monarchs. So, for example, I would say that the first two, James the First and Charles the First, were quite sincere Protestants. In the case of Charles the First, you have a monarch whose Protestantism was, in a sense, more sympathetic to what his opponents perceived to be a kind of pro-Catholic affect. He believed in the beauty of holiness. He was a supporter of images in churches, and he was very much an opponent of the more puritanical wing of English Protestantism. Now, then when you get beyond Charles the First, well, Charles the Second is an enigma when it comes to religion. For most of his reign, he was a dutiful Protestant. But of course, on his deathbed, he converts to Catholicism.
That's right.
And then James, of course, had converted well before that. And his religion was, in my view, it was, compared to his brothers, first of all, it was more deeply held, but also
yes,
it was more reckless.
Mm. The other thing that complicates it, Victor, is that they all seem to marry Catholic princesses. So they always had that at the back as well. So they were always being looked upon with an equal suspicion by their Protestant subjects because of this Catholic queen. We're just going to have to go for a break here, Victor. I know we've just sort of set the scene, but when we come back, I'd really like to delve deeper into this Popish plot, how it starts, because I think, unless you're going to tell me otherwise, I think there is a lesson to be learned here about how misinformation can lead to very difficult, fatal consequences for some. So you're listening to Professor Victor Stater, and we are discussing the Popish plot from 17th century Britain. We'll be back straight after these words. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio, and I'm in a fascinating conversation with LSU history professor Victor Stater, who's just published Hoax, the Popish Plot That Never Was, published by Yale University Press. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, well, this talk of 17th century Britain's all very interesting, but it's got no relevance to me sitting here in Alabama or another part of the United States. Well, let me tell you that it was King James I, who was a Stuart king, who issued the first Virginia Charter. Yes, and that established the colony of Virginia in North America in 1606. And thereafter, you know what happened next. But also, if you happen to have a King James Bible, well, guess who that King James was? Yes, the very same King James I, Stuart king of Great Britain. So, Victor, back to the Popish plot. Now, what's interesting me is we love conspiracies. We love talking about conspiracies and hoaxes. I mean, it's something that fascinates the human mind. And I grew up reading the established histories of that time, setting out that it was perhaps, you know, fabrication, you know, but it didn't dwell on that too much. But the question really is, who were the people behind Titus Oates? As we've said, he's a horrible figure. Why would anybody be interested in him? But there were very powerful influences that were using him to their own end.
Right. There certainly were. He was a useful tool for people who hoped to exploit the widespread belief on the part of your typical English Protestant that a Catholic was by definition up to no good. And it has relevance in our own time. You know, we see the proliferation of conspiracy theories that often have little or no basis in fact. Mm-hmm. But they fit the predisposition that people have to believe a narrative that suits their outlook. So this is very much the case in the 1670s, and people who hoped to exploit these fears, many were ambitious political figures who hoped to muscle out the current ministers who they had been ambitious to depose for several years, and they seized upon, you know, the word that spread so quickly through London about this fantastic assassination plot, and they were able to amplify and spread that narrative throughout Britain. This one of the important factors here is the fact that in the 1670s there is a tremendous expansion of the political press, and pamphlets and ballads and broadsides and books poured off the presses of Britain, and every printer and bookseller was anxious to get their piece of the pie, and they were certainly not at all critical about the information that they were distributing, the misinformation they were distributing. So there were a variety of reasons why this narrative took such a deep hold. It catered to popular prejudices. It was a potential tool to advance the political interests of certain important individuals like the Earl of Shaftesbury, who I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And there was a profit motive. There was a lively trade in Popish plot souvenirs, for example, and playing cards and medals, and there were even souvenir daggers on sale in London. People getting onto the bandwagon from every angle.
Absolutely. Wherever there's a plot, there's money to be had, as we know today, even. But, I mean, you're making me think then that really the Popish plot was a kind of false flag operation, to put it in modern parlance, which was preempting what was very much a coup d'etat 10 years later. Just to let our listener know, 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution, the legitimate king, King James II, was deposed by a mercenary army from Holland, with William of Orange and his bride Mary Stuart at its head, or as titular head. I mean, they were being used by other forces. I mean, essentially, am I being too simplistic, Victor, in thinking that the forces that were manipulating the population in 1678 were also then the forces which brought about that coup d'etat in 1688?
Well, there's definitely a direct connection. Many of the same figures are involved in both. And so, yes, there's clearly a very close connection. But one of the other things which I think is worth mentioning about all this is that in some ways the eruption of the plot and the degree to which it was taken as reality was kind of a reflection of the success of English Catholics in managing to continue their faith life under the radar. They had successfully built an infrastructure that enabled clergy to deliver the sacraments, that enabled generous Catholics to endow funds to support the Catholic mission. All of these things had been put into place in the context of a whole statute book full of vicious penalties for doing exactly what it was they were doing. But they did it so well that many in England had no clue as to the extent of the Catholic mission in England. And when investigation of Titus Oates' charges began, many of these secret provisions for the Catholic mission were uncovered, because Oates himself had been involved with the Catholic mission. He was in one of his desperate attempts to make a living. He had burned his bridges with the Church of England and thought to turn to the Catholic Church. So for a while, he was a member, or at least a hanger-on, of the Jesuit mission in London. And so he knew names, he knew locations connected with the mission. And when these things came out, people thought, oh my goodness, the threat is even greater than we imagined. But in fact, what it was a reflection of the fact that English Catholics had been so good at disguising themselves.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And Titus Oates, a man without any shame whatsoever. I've had a couple of questions texted in, Victor. I'll try and summarize them because I think you've covered some of this. But one of the questions was how much of what happened, the Popish plot, was a hangover from Oliver Cromwell. I think you've kind of touched on that, that the divisions within British society, within England in particular, were still very raw from the Civil War of the 1640s. But the subsequent question is, were the parties formed from this? And that's an interesting question, because I suppose the people working behind the scenes to depose the Catholic Stuarts, or the imminent rise of the Duke of York, James II, were they very much sort of roundheads, parliamentarians? Did they come from that side of the house?
They do, by and large. There are exceptions to every one of these, but by and large they are. And one of the things which makes the Popish plot, I think, a crucial event in British history is that although in the first few months the credibility of Oates and his fellow informants was almost universal, not entirely, but almost, fairly quickly thereafter, skepticism begins to grow. And as King Charles's opponents seize upon the plot narrative as a political tool, it gradually becomes a marker of your politics rather than your belief in any assassination conspiracy. And so what gradually emerges is what turns into the two-party political system that dominates the English-speaking world even to this day, with those who support the king ultimately being called Tories, and those who support the exclusion of James and who are highly invested in the reality of the plot becoming the Whigs. And so what's born as a result of this set of lies and conspiracies is this system in which you have two political parties competing one against another for political power. And I think in some ways this marks an important advance in politics in the English-speaking world, in that when in the 1640s you had two bitterly divided groups, the only solution, the only way they could see forward to resolving their divisions was to kill one another. Mm-hmm. And so you get a civil war. What emerges from the plot and the creation of the two political parties is the gradual growing sense that political differences do not necessarily have to result in open, outright war to the knife between those groups. It evolves over a generation or more, but it marks an important moment in which that process begins.
Absolutely. You're listening to the voice of Professor Victor Stater, who's the author of Hoax, which is all about the Popish plot, or as the title of the book says, the Popish plot that never was. However, history says that it did happen in the sense that it had repercussions, and we've only got a few moments left, Victor, but obviously, there were repercussions for Catholics, and one of the more celebrated of those is Oliver Plunkett, very much still a hero in Ireland. And it's strange that, how an Irish archbishop could get implicated in this, but also how he could end up being the last martyr at Tyburn here in London, Tyburn Tree, hanged, drawn and quartered, and also how that could happen under the sort of crypto-Catholic King Charles II. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I mean, does he feature largely in your book, Oliver Plunkett, he and his witness?
He does play a significant role towards the end. In a way, he is the final victim and obviously the most publicly known of all of the victims of the plot. And King Charles himself was extremely unhappy to leave Plunkett to his fate. And in fact, he was enraged by comments made by some of the oppositions sympathetic to Plunkett. Plunkett was actually well-liked by both Protestants and Catholics in Ireland. And some of the king's opponents who had been pushing the plot relentlessly actually wanted the king to pardon Plunkett, which it was technically within his power to do, but under the political circumstances of the moment, it was practically impossible. And the king responded to these pleas by saying that you have the blood of Oliver Plunkett on your hands because you have pushed this fake conspiracy. And what Charles does do, to his credit, is he tries to mitigate the impact on a number of less prominent Catholics. But unfortunately, Oliver was so prominent that to intervene to save him would have been foolhardy.
Absolutely. Victor, I could speak to you all morning. It's one of my favorite periods of history. I find it absolutely and endlessly fascinating. Tell people where they can find out more about you, and in particular, where they can pick up a copy of Hoax.
Well, I'm a professor, as you said, at LSU, and I'm there on the department's website, the history department's website, and the book you can find in the usual places on Amazon. There is an audio version so that you can go to those sellers of Audible and the like and download it from them. So I would be delighted if more people knew about the plot, and because it's such a fascinating moment in our history.
Yes, and I think it has lots and lots of interesting lessons to be learned for us here today. Victor, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Maybe you'll come back again. As I say, I find this an absolutely fascinating topic, the whole Stuart England thing. It's got wonderful, wonderful dimensions. But thank you very much for your time this morning.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we will be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency.